From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. The Arizona Cardinals are considered underdogs in today's game against the Carolina Panthers, but that's silly, because they're birds, not dogs. Ahead on Only a Game, a look at Arizona's year of overachievement amid much skepticism. Also, a conversation with Dungeons and Dragons survivor Mark Barrowcliffe about his new book, The Elfish Gene. Also ahead, a sixth-grade goalie crashes the varsity hockey party normally reserved for Lynn, Massachusetts high schoolers. But they don't mind.
Yeah, she's a great goalie and she's a great kid. And when she walks in the locker room, nobody knows she's in middle school. She just becomes one of us.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. It's been a season of milestones for the 2008 Arizona Cardinals, who've previously been associated with millstones, as in sinking. In going 9-7, the Cards enjoyed their first winning season since 1998, and they won the NFC West. They beat the Atlanta Falcons in the opening round of the playoffs last Saturday, thus earning their first home playoff win since 1947. Tonight, they face the Carolina Panthers. Joining me now to discuss what milestones may lay ahead for the Cardinals is Kent Summers, who covers the team for the Arizona Republic. Kent, welcome to Only a Game.
Oh, thanks for having me.
The Cardinals moved from St. Louis to Arizona back in 1988, and since then the team has had only two winning seasons. How would you characterize the fan base there, and have they rallied behind the Cardinals this season?
The fan base over those 20 years has really been noted for an ebb and flow. Very excited when the team moved here in 1988, bought a lot of season tickets, and then the team continued to lose. That season ticket base eroded. People got excited again when Buddy Ryan was hired in the mid-1990s. He flopped, and the fans pretty much went away. And when the team played in Sun Devil Stadium its first 17 seasons here at Arizona State Campus, it wasn't unusual to see as few as 25,000 fans here. Mm. They opened the University of Phoenix Stadium 3 years ago. That energized the fan base. It was a beautiful place to watch the game. And the team has got better over the last couple of years with the new coach, Ken Wisenhunt, and the staff that he's brought in.
Would you characterize those fans as still suspicious, or have they been entirely won over at this point by this season's success?
A bit suspicious. There's a nucleus of very hardcore fans who will follow this team through anything, and they've been through anything and everything. But the rest of the people, you know, the other, you know, 30,000 or so that show up to games, they come and go. They're not quite believers yet in this team. And this year is an example. This team was 7-3 at one point in the season, and people were very excited and ready to climb aboard a bandwagon. And then the team lost four of their last six and were blown out by 40 points in New England, 28 points in Philadelphia. And I think a lot of people that wanted to be Cardinal fans kind of, you know, thought, oh no, here we go again. And it's back now with that victory over the Falcons. I think that with a win today against the Panthers, could be in the NFC Championship game. And out of the 16 teams in the NFC, this is the only franchise that's never played in that game.
The Panthers, of course, edged the Cardinals when they played earlier in the season, 27-23. Can the Cardinals look at that game and say, well, here's what we have to do to turn that around, or was that too long ago to matter?
No, they've kind of pointed to that game all season as proof that they could be competitive on the road against a very good team. The Cardinals look back at the mistakes they made in that game and really believe, look, if we had eliminated just one of these things, we would have beaten a very good team on the road. But that's the huge hurdle this franchise has to overcome. That's the next one up. They've accomplished a lot this year, but that's the biggest one that remains undone.
Arizona's victory over Atlanta last weekend gave the Cardinals consecutive victories in home playoff games. However, those two wins were separated by 61 years. Is it premature at this point to say that Arizona has turned it around?
Yeah, I think so. I think the bigger news here is you look at those 61 years and you think you almost have to try with the goal being mine to be that bad over that amount of time. You know, I think you would think there would be years where you would almost just luck into a playoff appearance or a home playoff game. And it's no, I don't think they have turned the corner. It was funny sitting in the press box last weekend against Atlanta, and they were announcing as the Cardinals accomplished something in the playoffs. You know, this is a playoff record. This is a home playoff record. We've done this, and you thought, there's not a lot of history there to overcome when it comes to playoff records. But it's a constant battle. You know, they did this in 1998. They made the playoffs. They won a first round game at Dallas. It was the biggest win in the team's Arizona history. And then that offseason, they let three key veterans leave via free agency, and it just kind of took the heart and soul out of this team, and it collapsed, and they went through numerous coaching changes over the past 10 years. So it's one thing to get to this point, to have this success, and it's quite another to sustain it over another 10-year period.
Kent, your biography on your blog reads, "I spend my leisure time with my wife and three kids, and I ponder what it would be like to cover a winning season." Now, I know you've been busy because the Cardinals have been successful this season, so, no surprise that you haven't updated the biography. But I got to ask you, what has it been like covering the Cardinals' winning season?
It's the longer you're in the business and in the news business and journalism, the more you root for a good story, one way or the other. It's not necessarily that you root for the team to win. You just root for the different story. And that's what's made this year fun and interesting for me. It's like I told one of the players at midseason when they were, 7-3, I thought, I've never written the 7-3 story. I've written the 3-7 story plenty of times. But these are uncharted waters for me. But it's people like myself who have covered this team for a while. You know, you kind of look at each other and think, can you believe number one, covering football practice and games in January, that hasn't happened in forever. And number two, can you believe the Cardinals are at this point? I've covered numerous Super Bowls in my time, and I always, I don't expect them to get to the Super Bowl. They've got some huge obstacles to overcome. They're not at that point in their development yet. But I think it's going to be a fun organization to watch over the next two or three years.
Kent Summers covers the Cardinals for the Arizona Republic and blogs about the team at azcentral.com. Kent, thanks very much for speaking with me.
You're welcome.
The 28-7-5 Detroit Red Wings are the NHL's reigning champions. The Wings currently lead the Central Division. But earlier this season, the 22-9-7 Chicago Blackhawks threatened to overtake their arch rivals after a start few had predicted. And Chicago fans have noticed. Up until last year, the team was an afterthought to them, to the media, and some would say to its own management. That's a problem that has been remedied in part by the Blackhawks' bold public relations initiative that includes televising home games. From Chicago, Yolanda Perdomo reports.
Wearing almost exclusively red, white, and black, a crowd of 200 fans watches the team hold practice last weekend at a rink in suburban Chicago. Dozens more stand outside in the freezing cold, hoping for autographs or even a glimpse of their hockey heroes as they exit. It's where Mike Blecky and his daughter Emily wait. Blecky says there was a time when being a Blackhawks fan was a less than fun experience.
It was pretty frustrating for the last 7 or 8 years, pretty much 10 years, just following the team and, seeing that they're not going anywhere, and just hard as being a diehard fan. It's just hard to see that, and glad to see that they've come this way.
Now he says the team has gone out of its way to court old fans like himself and new ones like his daughter, who does what he never really could do as a kid: watch home games on TV. She likes the team's 20-year-old superstar, Patrick Kane, and emulates him when she plays for the Arctic Junior Fury Blackhawks.
I don't know, he's good, and I also play right wing. He scores a lot of goals, and so do I, and I like scoring. I like it a lot more, and now I'm a lot more into them. because now I can actually watch them and not just have to listen to them, and I can see their plays and try to do that in my games, or at least attempt.
The Blackhawks' first-round draft pick was named the NHL's 2007-2008 Rookie of the Year. Kane himself is struck at what a difference a year makes.
So it's amazing where it's come from now, and it's awesome. I think when you're looking on the bench last year, you're thinking, you know, we got to get some people in these seats. And for it to come this quick, for as many people that are coming to the games, you know, leading the league in attendance, things like that, it's really fun to see.
To understand this excitement, you have to go back a few decades. The Blackhawks franchise has been in the Wirtz family since the 1950s. Legendary Blackhawks Hall of Famers include Bobby Hull, Phil Antonio Esposito, Stan Mikita, and Dennis Savard. The owner was just as well known, but for different reasons, according to Tim Sassone, the Blackhawks reporter for the Daily Herald, who's covered the team for 21 years.
Bill Wirtz was stuck in his ways, you know, didn't want to really pay a lot of the top players. They let some of their great players go in the past, Chelios, Roenick, Belfour, in their prime. Fans never really forgave him for that. Started staying away, and as the team slipped, I mean, total non-interest from the fans' part. There was resentment on how they were treated. You know, all the players were let go and not replaced, and it's just totally different now.
When Wirtz died in 2007, his son Rocky took over and made immediate changes. He brought in former Chicago Cubs president John McDonough to revitalize the Hawks' marketing strategy, creating the first ever fan convention held last summer. And Scotty Bowman, the winningest coach in NHL history and former leader of the rival Detroit Red Wings, is now a senior advisor to the Blackhawks. But Sassone says the biggest change was a relatively basic one. The Hawks now televise home games.
And that's probably the biggest marketing tool that there is that this franchise completely ignored for decades. They came very close to skipping a whole generation of fans that they lost. You know, if things hadn't turned around quickly as it did in the last year or so, they might have lost a whole generation of kids that just didn't want to know hockey or didn't care. I've been here when they were great, I've been here when they were horrible, and, you know, it's a lot more fun coming to the rink when they're good, and they understand that talking to the media is part of their job, and, you know, the great personalities, it's just a fun place to be. You know, it's just great to be around this team.
The team hasn't made it to the playoffs since 2001 and hasn't hoisted the Stanley Cup since 1961. Currently the longest drought in the NHL. The All-Star Game unofficially marks the second half of the season, but Blackhawks fans hope it's only the beginning of their team's journey to a championship. For Only a Game, I'm Yolanda Perdomo in Chicago.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. A January 1st law requiring the operators of motorcycle taxis in Nigeria to wear helmets has inspired some creative headgear options. Unwilling to spend the money for actual helmets, some of the taxi drivers have been tying clay pots, plates, or pieces of rubber tire to their heads with string. Others have been using calabashes, the dried shells of a pumpkin-sized fruit, as helmets. The passengers in the motorcycle taxis are also required to wear helmets, but they have been similarly reluctant to do so, maintaining that by so doing they might catch ringworm or dandruff. Apparently, none of them feared that without the helmets they might catch fractured skull.
And if you wear a helmet, legal check.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a high school hockey goalie who won't be a high school student until late 2011. But first, Major League Baseball announced 50-game suspensions for two players this week. Phillies reliever J.C. Romero and Yankees minor league pitcher Sergio Mitre tested positive after taking over-the-counter supplements sold in big chain nutrition stores in the United States. Both players carefully checked the labels on the supplements for substances on the banned list, but league officials say that's not enough. Phil Sheridan covers baseball for the Philadelphia Inquirer. He joins me now on the line. Phil, welcome to Only a Game.
Pleasure to be here, Bill. Appreciate the time.
Let's focus on J.C. Romero, who won two games in the World Series last fall. He has said he did everything he could to make sure the supplement he bought was safe, but it's been reported that Major League Baseball produced a bottle of the same supplement at a hearing, and the label on that supplement read, quote, "Use of this product may be banned by some athletic or government associations." How careful could Romero have been?
Well, that's a good question. I have talked to Romero, and I've talked to people who have seen the arbitrator's report, and apparently the bottle that Romero purchased did not have that label, and Romero's agents went to the same vitamin shop store in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, that he bought the supplement, and they saw bottles on the shelves that didn't have the label. So it's not clear when that label started appearing on the bottle or why. Mm. But Romero's bottle and the arbitrator's report acknowledges that the two bottles are different, have different labeling, and the bottle Romero bought did not have that that warning on it.
There may have been an element of luck involved here.
Well, it's really bad luck all around. I mean, he told me on the phone the other night, Romero did, in the conversation I had with him, that he was looking at the supplement he's been using for years, and it has larger pills that he finds unpleasant to take. So he thought, oh, here's one right next to it that the pills are smaller, and you only have to take four instead of eight a day. And that's the only reason he bought the supplement. So that's the definition of bad luck, I think.
Romero also says that he brought the supplement to Phillies strength coach Doug Lean, and Lean sent a sample to Major League Baseball for testing, but when the sample came back positive, Romero says Lean didn't let him know that. Major League Baseball says Lean told Romero from the start not to take the supplement. Who should we believe on this one?
Yeah, well, this is problematic. Lean has not been available to comment on this. The Phillies have not made him available. They say that he handled things properly, and they're standing by his actions. It's really not clear. Romero says that he showed him the bottle, and Lean said, I would get a second opinion before I use that. I would check that out. And that he then took some of the pills, I guess, and sent them into baseball. The Players Association has a procedure where you can send a bottle, your supplements, to MLB Players Association, and they will test it for you. But, and here's the catch on this. This is why the system probably needs a little work. They will not send the bottle back to you. Once you send it in for testing, you give it up. You lose it. And they can verify or vouch for another bottle of the same supplement. That second bottle could be tainted. And it's really a way for the Players Association to not be culpable. It's a way to avoid responsibility. As to Lean versus Romero's stories, you know, they're not that different. I just think there may have been a communication problem.
Romero also says the union advised players that supplements bought in retail stores in the United States should be safe, but the league's Rob Manfred says the league and the union have, quote, consistently told players there's risk associated with nutritional substances purchased over the counter, no matter where they're purchased. Has that message been consistent?
I don't think it has. In talking to Romero and the people that have been trying to sort this out for him, the pattern seems to be that Latin players are the guys being told this because they're basically being discouraged from buying products in the Dominican Republic or Mexico or Puerto Rico or the places where they, you know, they may live in the off season, or Venezuela. The products in those places are not regulated at all in many cases, and so baseball seems to be nudging these guys toward U.S. stores because of FDA regulation. But there's a huge problem with FDA regulation. People thought it was better than it is. And Washington Post did a series last year where they had supplements tested. You know, they found anabolic steroids in supplements that were supposed to be regulated by the FDA. So it's a huge problem. It's a problem that has nothing to do in that sense with baseball. It's a huge problem for a high school athlete can go in and get an over-the-counter supplement with steroids in it and not know that's what he's getting. And we know where that leads.
You're on the record as being something of a skeptic when it comes to the excuses athletes have made and make after testing positive for banned substances. What makes you feel inclined to believe Romero?
You're right. I have in the past, and I've been bothered often more by the lying than the cheating. When they lie, then when an innocent person comes along and says the same thing, they sound like a liar. You know, the Marion Jones act, where she looks doe-eyed and offended by the accusation that she could possibly be cheating. And then, you know, her story turns out to be a lie. In this case, baseball tested Romero. They tested the substance, and baseball itself says the substance was this over-the-counter supplement. There's no doubt that this is what caused it. It's not Floyd Landis having, you know, a high testosterone to epitestosterone ratio and saying it was Jack Daniels. It's he checked the label. There's nothing on the label. Everybody agrees there's nothing on the label that's banned by baseball. He technically violated the drug policy, but he's been suspended for 50 games and will lose $1.25 million, and that's more than Barry Bonds or Sammy Sosa or Mark McGwire was ever punished. They're suspending guys for jaywalking when they let axe murderers walk for years. That's basically what we're looking at.
As January baseball stories go, this has been fairly large. I wonder if it would be as large if the player in question hadn't won two games in the World Series last fall.
Well, that's certainly an issue, and there will be discussion, and I'm sure when Romero comes back in late May or early June, whenever the 50 games is up, he's going to get some feedback from the fans who feel maybe this is a tainted World Series victory. He was tested again before the postseason, and there was nothing in his urine at that point. He had stopped using the supplement the minute that he was told he had tested positive the first time. There was nothing in his urine in a test right before the postseason started, so he was not, you know, getting any illegal benefit from anything during the actual postseason. So, yeah, it's an unfortunate set of circumstances. But he was pitching in the World Series after this arbitrator's hearing. So baseball knew well before the postseason that he'd committed this ghastly crime and didn't act on it until now.
Phil Sheridan writes for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Phil, thanks very much for joining me.
My pleasure, Bill. Thanks.
The Lynn English High School girls' ice hockey team is unusual for several reasons, not the least of which is that many members of the team don't attend Lynn English High School, which is located just north of Boston. Because there aren't enough female hockey players at Lynn English to make up a team, first-year coach Anthony Martucci has recruited players from Lynn Classical High School and from high schools in the neighboring towns of Winthrop and Revere and from the Pickering Middle School in Lynn as well. In the locker room at the public rink in Lynn on Wednesday evening, as the Lady Bulldogs prepared to face visiting Wilmington, demonstrating how naive a visitor to the North Shore could be, I asked assistant captain Ashley Fandaka whether the team drew fans from all of the five schools represented by the players.
No one comes to watch us and we're undefeated. 5-0.
How can no one come to watch you? You're undefeated?
I don't know. No one's really interested in us, I guess, because we're all rivals, and I guess if all the kids from all the schools came, there'd be a big fight.
The students who've neglected the Lynn English games have been missing a good show. Not only have the players demonstrated that they can comfortably put school affiliations behind them in the name of team, they've been anchored by a goalkeeper for whom high school is still a future consideration, as in several years in the future.
Their goalie got hurt, so Madison's father over there, her dad asked us to play, and I said, yeah, after he got the waiver.
That's 11-year-old Katie Burt, and the waiver she mentioned made it possible for Lynn English to use a goalkeeper who's in the sixth grade, which is not to say Katie Burt lacks goaltending experience. She started playing the position in street hockey games with her older brother, and she's been stopping pucks against older players for youth hockey teams for several years.
Other teams know she's younger, and they think they'll easily beat us just because she's in sixth grade, but they don't know what's coming.
Taylor Brown, one of the flashiest skaters on the Lady Bulldogs, plays defense, meaning that one of her responsibilities is to keep the other team from unduly peppering Katie. Though some of her teammates talk about taking care of Katie, Taylor Brown has recognized that on the ice, her goalie's capable of taking care of herself.
Yeah, she's a great goalie and she's a great kid. And when she walks in the locker room, nobody knows she's in middle school. She just becomes one of us.
When she's on the ice, nobody knows Katie's in middle school either. Under all that goalie's equipment, she could be 13. Or she could be 30. But before Wednesday night's game, it was evident that the coach of the Wilmington team, Joe McMahon, knew who would be in the opposing net, and he wasn't crazy about the circumstance.
I don't want sixth graders. I mean, they're way too young. They need to develop more. And plus, if you bring them in that young, It may scare them, and you may not be able to get them back.
Through waivers similar to the one Katie Burt needed, Joe McMahon has secured the services of some seventh graders for his team, but mostly they watch from the bench.
It's a huge age difference. I mean, I have seniors on the team. I have girls that have ferocious slap shots, and I don't play my seventh graders unless I'm sure they can handle it. It's their first year here. They're in the locker room with the high schoolers, and I'm very cautious of when I put them in.
Coach McMahon's understanding of the waiver process is that coaches should use it when they don't have enough high school players to make up a team. He's dubious about Lynn English recruiting Katie Burt rather than converting one of the players they already had into a goalkeeper. But Katie's mother, Chris Burt, felt no hesitation about encouraging her daughter to play with and against girls and young women as much as 7 years older.
I was a little excited. You know, I think it was a huge challenge for her, and I obviously like to see her be challenged and just step up to the plate and make it happen. I think it's good to be challenged. I think that makes you a better person. I think it makes you a better player. Basically, it makes you better in whatever you do.
It's hard to argue against the benefits of being challenged, but this particular challenge involves off-ice variables. Had Katie's parents considered that the 17- and 18-year-olds in the Lynn English locker room might be discussing various matters that might still be exceedingly mysterious to their 11-year-old daughter? Jim Burt says they had.
That was really the only concern I had, but the girls are unbelievable. They really are. I mean, I can't say it's not going on, but it's definitely not going on in the locker room. They know she's there, and they take care of her.
On Wednesday night against Wilmington, Katie Burt's teammates did not look after her quite well enough. Wilmington scored first, and though Taylor Brown contributed a flashy goal after a rink-length rush to tie the game in the second period, Wilmington had the best of the play from then on. The last few minutes of the third period saw first one team, then the other, rendered shorthanded by silly penalties. In the closing seconds, Katie Burt left the ice to allow Lynn English to put on another shooter. It didn't work. Wilmington won 3-1, and for Lynn English, the dream of an undefeated season died. Lynn English coach Anthony Martucci was not discouraged by the performance of his team or his 11-year-old goalie.
Katie had to make a lot of good saves. She's a great goalie. She stands tall in there. I mean, two nice goals they had. You can't beat them with one-timer across. That's not Katie's fault. You know, that's just a great play by them. And then, you know, we didn't put the puck in the net far. One goal's not going to win you a game.
Do you have to say anything to her? She's old. She's 12 years old almost. Is this the kind of thing that's going to discourage her? Is she going to be okay?
No, Katie will be fine. I'm going to go in there. I'll just tell her she did a great job because she really did. She's going to know what the situation was, and she'll be ready to go for the next one.
For the Lynn English girls hockey team, the next one will be this evening against Marblehead on the road. And if Katie Burt stays with it, she'll be looking at next ones as a high school goalie until late in the winter of 2015.
Probably. I don't know. Maybe they have a different goalie. I'll let her have a chance.
Maybe. But probably no aspiring female goalie in Lynn, Winthrop, or Revere over the age of 11 should count on. You're listening to Only a Game. I understand this is NPR, so Only a Game is not a real sports program, but come on! That's how Tim Tuttle of Boise, Idaho, began the email he sent us this week. Mr. Tuttle was upset that although I mentioned that Utah had beaten Alabama to go undefeated, I didn't celebrate same as enthusiastically as I would have if Only a Game was a real sports program. Mark Scott, the news director at WBFO in Buffalo, and Kate Reben were among the listeners who felt that our college football analyst, Dan Wetzel, showed insufficient respect for the University of Buffalo football team. the most understated comment on Mr. Wetzel's judgment, characterized it as uninformed. Robert Plum of Coronado, California, was among the many listeners who noticed that Charlie Pierce's predictions about last weekend's NFL playoff games crashed. "I heard something about the Colts doing horrible things to the Chargers," Mr. Plum wrote. "Then I saw the game. Maybe it was supposed to be the other way around." Hank Stark, who hears Only a Game on WEOS in Ithaca, New York, opined on Charlie's picks as follows. "Mr. Pierce, like me, is human. Perhaps he, like me, could use a bit of humility. I know you're friends, but why don't you call him on those predictions? It might make a lot of your listeners happy. I promise to try to wake myself up on time to hear it next Saturday. Maybe I'll even roll out of bed with glee." Charlie is next. Jacob Kenner, an animal trainer at Best Friend Pet Care in St. Louis, Missouri, wrote in reference to last week's story about the Rat Olympics. Mr. Kenner pointed out that the trained rats don't perform because they hear a clicking noise. When they perform, they are rewarded with food, and the reward is accompanied by the clicking noise, which is a secondary reinforcer in the process of operant conditioning. "These days, there are too many sources of misinformation about animal behavior," he wrote. "I would hate to see Only a Game become one of them." That story also provoked Don Becker of West Roxbury, Massachusetts, to write as follows. "You relaxed your journalistic standards by not inquiring into the possibility that students would use drugs to enhance the performance of their rats. But," Mr. Becker acknowledged, "the issue is unlikely to be investigated because very few people give a rat's anyway." If you give same about this or anything else you've heard on the program, you can reach us through our website, onlyagame.org. You can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860, or you can write us at Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Reside, providing vintage home accessories, lighting, and furnishings by 20th century classic modern designers. Collections on view at resideinc.com. And Account Temps, a global provider specializing in temporary staffing of accounting and finance professionals, locations worldwide. Details at accounttemps.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
"I love my fans, but this is actually a little over the top." So spoke Mahendra Singh Dhoni, captain of India's cricket team. He was referring to a white marble statue of himself, which will be built as the centerpiece of a temple in his hometown, Ranchi. The temple will also feature relief carvings of the player in action. In these carvings, Dhoni will look down on his disciples as they pay homage to his success on the cricket pitch during a career in which he led India to victory in the inaugural 2020 World Cup in South Africa. "Dhoni is a god to cricket," says the president of the player's fan club. "He will be worshipped like other gods are worshipped in temples." I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, boys who consider evil wizards, slimy dungeons, and exploding fireballs to be a lot less scary than girls. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill, and I'd like to say hello, and I know they're emerging blinking and staggering from the rubble that was the Phil Fulmer era here, but I'd like to say hello to our new listeners at WUOT HD2. In Knoxville, Tennessee, and if I may just say, good old Rocky Top, Rocky
Summit
Top,
custom.
Tennessee, woohoo!
Florida beat Oklahoma on Thursday night to take the BCS title. A worthy champion?
I don't care. It was an awful football game. If there was ever an excuse for doing away with the bowl championship series, this was it. Florida won. They were better than Oklahoma. Why? Because you could play almost anyone against Oklahoma in this game, and Oklahoma would lose. The gushing over quarterback Tim Tebow by the Fox broadcast crew was perhaps unprecedented in the history of broadcast television. I mean, I like Tim Tebow. He seems like a nice enough guy. I hope he succeeds and doesn't get overly injured playing in the NFL, but I'm already sick to death of him. The football players from the University of Southern California must have been lounging around the football dorm just laughing their heads off.
Well, and they may not be the only ones. Utah Attorney General Mark Shurtleff says BCS may violate antitrust laws. BCS argues that that's rubbish. Mr. Shurtleff's assertion wouldn't have anything to do with the fact that Utah was the nation's only undefeated team, would it?
It's complete rubbish, and Mr. Shurtleff knows that, and he's grandstanding for the home folks. And if this is another thing that BCS prompts, you know, a nationwide sort of public useless pandering by our politicians, I think it's another reason to get rid of the system.
Our recently reconvened Congress has a lot of work to do these days, Charlie. Nobody could argue otherwise. How do you feel about the priorities of Representative Cliff Stearns, R. Florida?
This is a guy who joined in that farce earlier this year that we all have to come back to work. Don't go on vacation. We have to come back to work and pass a waiver to start drilling offshore for oil.
Now.
Okay. So now, however, we all have to take a couple of days off so Congressman Stearns can go watch the Gators. No thanks.
Do you want to make some picks in
this weekend? No, not after last week, no.
You see what happened?
Are you out of your mind?
I was going to say you could rest on your laurels from last week, but that joke is shot.
Well,
now,
do you know where my laurels are? Because I certainly didn't get any new ones. I don't know. I still think the Baltimore Ravens are the one team I don't want to play if I'm any other team in the playoffs. I don't have the faintest idea on the Eagles and the Giants. I just know it's hard to beat a team three times in a year. And as far as the Cardinals and the Panthers, that game is a pick 'em. The Chargers and the Steelers should win that depending on whether dingy quarterback Ben Roethlisberger is at 60% or not. The Ravens and the Titans is the game that intrigues me. And what the hell, I'll go way out on a limb and pick the Ravens.
Philadelphia Phillies reliever J.C. Romero was suspended for 50 games. This was announced on Tuesday after an August 26th positive test for a banned substance. An arbitrator ruled that the 33-year-old pitcher was negligent in not knowing what was in an over-the-counter supplement. Romero claims that the supplement was approved by Major League Baseball, the Players Union, and the Philadelphia Phillies strength coach. And he claims he's innocent. Does Romero have a point?
He has a very good point, and this is a classic example of a pound of overreaction for an ounce of cure. This is a pure outgrowth of a public relations strategy, not a medical strategy, not a workplace safety strategy. This is Major League Baseball trying to cover itself. It's very embarrassing for the institution.
Former Portland Trailblazers forward Darius Miles was cut for medical reasons last year with $18 million outstanding on his contract. Miles was deemed, quote, medically unable to play, so his salary came off the books. Miles played 8 games for Memphis this season before the Grizzlies released him on Tuesday. If he signs with another team and plays just 2 more games, the Blazers will be on the hook for a whopping luxury tax hit, which prompted Portland to circulate a memo to all the other NBA teams warning them that if they sign Darius Miles, they'll face litigation. Preposterous?
It is preposterous. Go ahead, sign him. Let Portland try to litigate this. There's a restraint of trade lawsuit sitting in the middle of the road like a big old rock. The Portland Trailblazers are being idiotic in this situation. I can't believe David Stern hasn't stepped in and resolved this by now.
Charlie, we all know that Michael Jordan never traveled. He was allowed by the officials to take as many steps as he needed to make a play worthy of the highlight reel. Has somebody failed to tell the NBA refs that LeBron James should be extended the same privilege?
Well, hey, he was doing the crab dribble.
It was the crab dribble.
He did the crab dribble. You know what? I remember reading Claire B's Winning Basketball about the crab dribble.
No.
It's legal. James Naismith's right in the original 12 rules of basketball. You may not carry the ball except for the crab dribble.
Right.
You know what? LeBron James will never get called for this again in his entire career.
Well, you may very well be right, but this was one of the few games that I actually was watching when when this particular event occurred. And the first thing that occurred to me was, he's traveling!
No, he did the crab dribble!
The biggest January story in golf regards speculation about where and when Tiger Woods will attempt to reoccupy his throne. What's the lucky venue likely to be?
I think it will likely be one of the Florida stops prior to the Masters. He and his wife have another child coming in February. There's really no hurry, but he really does need to play somewhere before the Masters. And I think probably I don't mean to be cynical or anything, but I suspect there's a little bidding going on behind the scenes.
On Thursday, Manchester United reported that their star winger, Cristiano Ronaldo, was, quote, training as normal with the team. Any reason we should doubt that?
Well, he piled up his Ferrari in a tunnel near the Manchester airport and decided, as Mike Tyson once did with a Bentley, that this car was more trouble than it's worth and just sort of left it there.
and trained normally with the team.
Very normally. He was involved in an incident involving his car and a wall.
And finally, the annual two-day dog race near Frazee, Minnesota was canceled this week. This may not seem especially noteworthy, as the race has been canceled on two previous occasions, each time for lack of snow. However, the reason for this year's cancellation may strike some as unlikely.
Well, it makes sense because dogs cannot mush the sleds through 3 or 4 or 5 feet of snow. There was too much snow in and around Bemidji, Minnesota, and they had to cancel the dog sled race on account of snow. I think it's probably time to put wheels on the sleds and move it to a southern venue.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, and he joins me each week at this time on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
Rocky Top, Tennessee.
Let it snow.
Of Dungeons and Dragons, the fantasy game into which he plunged headlong as an adolescent in Coventry, England, Mark Barrowcliffe writes, "An obsession is a way for damaged people to damage themselves more." Happily, as an adult, Mark Barrowcliffe gained the perspective from which he could write about his obsession and his eventual escape from same, and the result is The Elfish Gene, Dungeons, Dragons, and Growing Up Strange. Mark Barrowcliffe joins me now from the studios of the BBC in Brighton, England. Mark, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks very much.
Some of our listeners may not be familiar with Dungeons and Dragons. You write of the game that it is, quote, unprecedented in human history because it's a story you can listen to at the same time you're telling it. Explain, please.
Well, briefly, it's a kind of narrative story. The best way of describing it I've come up with is that it's like one of these World of Warcraft games or something like that. Computer games before they had computers. So where in the computer game you'll see a generated image, in Dungeons and Dragons, you'll have that scene described to you by someone who's gone through beforehand and designed this entire world according to a set of rules. So he'll say you're standing before a heavily embossed wooden door, lights pouring out from under it. What do you do? Well, we send our thief to the door, a specialist thief, and he listens. Well, he can hear the sounds of goblins talking behind. Okay, we all draw our swords, bash down the door, in we go. Girls love this stuff, believe me.
No, yes.
There's a set of rules which determine, you know, how you fight the goblins. In fact, there's a set of rules that determine everything from your hair colour to the weight of the rations that you're eating. Hmm. So it's a fantasy world delineated in pen, paper and the imagination, rather than a fantasy world delineated in computer bytes.
The boys inclined to be fascinated by such things as imaginary wizards, mysterious fireballs, dungeon-dwelling monsters of various kinds. They tend to find other similarly obsessed dweebs. This is your word for that group. But of your early Dungeons & Dragons days, you write that you were too nerdy even for the dweebs. That must have been a discouraging discovery.
Well, it was terrible at the time because I was actually ostracized by my group. But in my small defense, there's not much in my defense, but in my defense, I was just nearly 12. And a lot of the guys I was playing with were nearly 15 or 15. And that's a big difference. And I was an immature 12-year-old. And to be fair to them, they were immature 15-year-olds. but we were both, you know, I was probably had a mental age around 8 and they probably had a mental age around 12. I mean, the game was all my dreams come true. I'd been a major fantasy nut as a kid growing up. Read The Hobbit until the words came off the page. And to be able to act all that out was just terrific to me. And unfortunately, I did actually act it out. You know, why call on the ancient powers to smite thee down, sir? You know, just roll the dice and shut up, Mark. You know, it's like these guys who play this game, a lot of us anyway, not everybody, but those of us who are real obsessives, were obsessed with kind of sophistication. And as with a lot of human behaviour, liking D&D is a way of feeling better than other people, i.e. we have this secret code, we have this secret world, which you jock, know nothing about. And, you know, if only you were more intelligent, you would like it too. And you'd stop that gym class because you'd know that this was much more important. Important, that's how we felt, important.
Among your fellow players, the one who struck me as most remarkable was Billy Crowbraw. I hope I've pronounced that correctly.
Well, you've pronounced it correctly in American terms. It's Billy Crowbraw.
Crowbraw.
Yeah.
Well, tell us a little bit about how you first met him and the impression that he made on you.
Well, Billy, as I say in the book, Billy looked to me exactly like a golden dragon would have looked had he decided to appear as an extremely overweight schoolboy. He had a kind of bright plume of yellow hair. He was very, very fat, very expansive in his way of talking, smoked cigarette after cigarette, you know, at age 15. He just smoked one off the other and could quote everything from Shakespeare to physics, chemistry. I mean, he seemed, at the time, to me, he was easily the brightest and most impressive person I'd ever met. You know, when I first met him, he was sitting in a war games club, smoking away. And I said, "Oh, can I sit next to you?" And the first thing he said to me was, "Sit down betwixt the wind and his nobility," and let out this enormous fart. This is typical of Billy. It's not just something he trotted out. I got the feeling he could have done anything, really, in his life, almost anything, other than meet a girl. I mean, to his he was always fat, very fat, and that was unusual in England in the 1970s, very unusual. And I think that kind of obviously gave him pause with girls, really.
Well, we need to get into this whole issue of girls and their absence in the Dungeons and Dragons world.
You say that wrong. If you're going to say girls, as we would have said it when we were D&Ders at that age, you have to say it like this. You have to say, "Girls!"
I don't think I can do it.
Girls!
I'm going to count on you for that.
and then you have to go absolutely bright red and put your hand up to your forehead and hide your eyes
kind of thing.
Which is how I used to react to the presence of my friend's sisters very often.
Well, you write of yourself in these D&D days that you were, quote, "a bullied, power-hungry twerp with no discernible skill in conventional fields and no immediate hope of a girlfriend who wasn't mentally ill." To what extent was the discovery of the opposite sex responsible for the end of your days as a fantasy gamer?
Well, 100%, because in groups like ours, I know there are groups that have women in them. In fact, a reasonable percentage of the sales of role-playing games go to women. But in our group, it just could not have sustained that, because any girl that I ever bought into that group would have immediately been the target for ridicule, horrible practical jokes. And I can remember one of my friends saying to me when I got this girlfriend, "Oh, you know, you should bring her to this rock festival we're going to." He said, "You know, if you go to this rock festival, you'll be able to, And I was, "What?" "He said, you'll be able to sleep with her." And I said, "Well, we do that already." And his face kind of contorted into the shape of a sort of bright red walnut. And he just said, "No, you don't." And I said, "Well, we do." And the next game I had, I was subjected to about 2-hour interrogation on what's it like in order to establish whether I was lying or not. And at the end of it, they concluded that I was lying because it wasn't exactly as one other boy had described it. Having said that, they were right. I was lying.
I should mention that, you know, you did your job as a researcher in preparing to write this book. You actually returned to the Dungeons and Dragons table as an adult before, you know, finishing the book. How did that go?
It went awfully, and everybody that I went to this game with was depressingly exactly like the boys I'd played with when I was 15. I mean, this one guy, he said, "Oh, you're a writer, aren't you?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "What format do you use?" And then he kind of went on about computer programs of some sort. And I said, "No, I'm a writer. I write books." He said, "What, like on the shelf?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Well, you've got a publisher." "Yes." "You can buy them in shops." "Well, some of them, yeah." And he kind of balled up in on himself and just said, "Well, I think you will find that I am a consummate storyteller." And I was... "Yeah, mate, yeah, well, good." "Well, pleased to hear it." But having said that, obviously through this book, I've been in contact with a lot more gamers, and there are plenty of guys out there, and it is still largely guys, but there are plenty of guys out there who are perfectly normal and perfectly nice. But I think maybe I just have a bad luck magnet stuck somewhere where you can't see it on me. Mm. And, you know, I've since written a fantasy novel, sold it to a publisher, and yes, I'm, although no one will ever buy it because no one's interested in them anymore, I'm designing my own role-playing game again now. So, yeah, I went back to Mordor, where the shadows lie, at the end of this book.
Mark Barrowcliff is the author of The Elfish Gene, Dungeons, Dragons, and Growing Up Strange, a memoir. It's published by Soho. Mark Barrowcliff joined me from the BBC studios in Brighton, England. Mark, thank you very much for speaking with me. It's been a delight.
Thank you.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabue. Our technical director is John Parati, and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view our photo gallery of the Lynn English girls ice hockey team, download our weekly podcast, or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. Our final word is from Jim Burt, father of 11-year-old Lynn English High School goalie Katie Burt, who comments on his daughter's motivation.
There's no gun to her head.
Nah, just your vulcanized rubber pucks heading toward her head there to wicked velocity. Jeez. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.